Welcome to the Second in Command podcast, produced by the COO Alliance and brought to you by its founder, Cameron Harold. In the Second in Command podcast, we talk to top COOs who share the insights, strategies, and tactics that made them the chief behind the chief. And now, here's your host, Cameron Harold.
Gadi Shamia is the Chief Operating Officer at Talkdesk, and for the last 3.5 years, he has operated as the COO at Talkdesk. Talkdesk is the fastest growing SaaS contact center startup with thousands of customers like Shopify, IBM, Pete's Coffee, Dropbox, Peloton, Stitch, Fix, and 2U. Talkdesk is funded by Draper Fisher Jurvetson, Salesforce Ventures, and Storm Ventures, twice named in the Forbes Cloud 100 list, was listed as the Forbes Next $1 billion Company or Unicorn, and is also the youngest company ever to make the Gartner's CSaaS Magic Quadrant. So pretty cool stuff going to be coming up. At Talkdesk, Gadi is responsible for product, post-sales, renewals, customer service, professional sales, training, customer support, business development, channels, talent, legal, and people, and also supporting the CEO on all other areas. He's got 20 years of experience in software, 13 years in SaaS. He founded 3 companies, has also been the CEO at prior companies as well. Largest company that he founded ended up doing $1 billion a year in global business. And we're going to be talking a lot around hiring and communication and leadership. I actually really enjoyed this interview with Gadi and really looking forward to being able to share it with you as well. Gadi Shamia, the Chief Operating Officer from Talkdesk, and I'm really looking forward to actually learning a little bit about you. I was introduced to your company from Harley Finkelstein, who is the second in command at Shopify. I met Harley, gosh, about 8 years ago. I was in for a tour of their startup, and he and I have stayed in touch over the years. In fact, he was probably one of the good inspirations for me in even starting the Second in Command podcast. So looking forward to learning a little bit from you today.
Great to be here.
Thank you. And where are you coming in from today?
I'm in San Francisco right now, downtown, overlooking Mission Street.
Awesome.
We're right by the Salesforce Tower that is being erected here.
That's kind of the epicenter of technology. That place is amazing what they're building right now. Holy moly.
Yeah, I learned a lot about construction just working in here in the last few years. Everything is being built around us.
Yeah, there's also one of my favorite dim sum places, and I can't remember the name of it, is super close to there as well. It's old school dim sum, massive. It'll come to me later. So, Gods, why don't you tell us how you got started with Talkdesk, where you kind of came into it, and what your experience, what kind of experience set you up for this?
Yeah, and a quick correction, it's Gadi. You missed the I. Once you become old enough, it's hard to walk anyone through your resume because it's long and boring. But I did start my career in technology somehow as an accident. I was studying accounting and economics in the Tel Aviv University, and a friend of a friend introduced me to an entrepreneur. It was not called this way back then, that started a company. It was not called a startup back then. And it was looking for just someone smart. And apparently I fit that bill somehow. And I joined this company. It was almost a garage. We actually worked out of the warehouse of the clothing store of the other founder's wife. And we built an ERP software for SMB customers for the Israeli market. It was a pretty exciting opportunity for me. I never worked with technology. I was not a software engineer. The new creations every day, the new challenge, the new tasks that we had to overcome were a huge challenge and helped me really shaped the way I think about working and leading, but also being part of a startup. So this was the first part of my journey, and again, I can talk for hours. But
yeah, and Gadi, had you focused on software engineering in school or as part of your education, or did you just dive right into a software business?
No, when I went to school, which was in the early 90s, it was not cool to study software engineering. If you look at which were the hardest faculties to get into, back then was accounting, economics, business administration and law. It was actually trivial to get into computer science in the best universities in Israel. So I didn't really even think about it as a career opportunity for myself. I thought of myself as a business person. I want to study something will help me in business. I want to be practical. So I studied accounting and economics as a practical type of subject. And I didn't really practice as an accountant, but this background helped me build an ERP product, which is now used by tens of thousands of businesses around the world.
So, okay. So you actually dove into one of the subjects that I was scared to death of in college, which was accounting and finance. And one of the things I notice about COOs or second in commands is they often run varying business areas. We're really kind of the yin and yang to the CEO. So with TalkDesk, what are you running in terms of your, you know, what falls underneath you and what falls under in terms of the org chart under the CEO?
And you know, this is an interesting point because I met during the last few years many CEOs, and each one of them have somehow a different mix. And I think it's, yeah, as you describe it correctly, it's a yin and yang. And it's not classically CEOs run the back office, CEOs run the front. In many companies, it's really just based on what the CEO and the CEO want to do and are good at. So
right.
At TalkDesk, I'm running a really interesting mix. I'm running product. A lot of it because of my product background. I'm running the channel initiative again. A lot of it because of my channel background. I run everything post-sales, which is our customer success team, professional services, support, and training. I run talent, HR, probably our platform initiative, and several other areas where the CEO runs sales, marketing, and engineering and finance. So despite my accounting background, in our case, the CEO runs finance as well.
Oh, interesting. So so you had an accounting background. Now, did the CEO have an accounting or finance background, or they just decide to keep that as part of, you know, their focus?
You know, we had when I joined TalkDesk, we had a 20-minute conversation of what would make sense when it comes to splitting the company, and this is how it stuck.
Let's kind of dive in and let's do it. Now, it wasn't TalkDesk that was the small startup in the garage, was it, or was that?
No. TalkDesk was a small startup in a stuffy office in Mountain View. It was not very large when I joined it.
So what is it that's part of your makeup that has you joining, you know, I guess one of your first early stage companies so early, kind of working out of a warehouse and then, you know, joining TalkDesk as a small entrepreneurial startup? What is it that's part of your DNA that makes that either exciting or interesting versus getting into, you know, a bigger organization like a Salesforce right across the street?
So I skipped some points in a way. When I joined Top Manage and helped build this company, I was 20-something, 23 or 4. And for me, it was great to work out of this warehouse. It was pretty fancy. I came from the military and live in tents. And so this was exciting for me. It was very different. It was touching technology, working with Mac computers that were pretty fancy back then. So it was very, very different. This company ended up being acquired by SAP. So I did spend 6 years at SAP as a senior VP and a GM, and had a chance to kind of live life and fly over the world in business class and go to fancy hotels and have a driver pick me up and, you know, everything else that a senior role in a large organization affords you. But I didn't get the same level of excitement and that you get in a small, fast-moving startup. And when I left SAP, actually my son asked me, why would you do that? I think they paid you a lot of money. And he obviously was like, I think it was 10 back then. I said, yes, they pay me a lot of money, but it's not enough, son. And I think that part of me is really interested in the building and the novelty of different challenges every day, of solving your problem every day and challenging a status quo rather than maintaining a status quo. So a lot of what drives me is how can you take something that is still small and not necessarily fully shaped and shape it? And even during my time at SAP, this was actually my role because I was leading a whole new area at SAP, the SMB space. But once the SMB space became mainstream, it was not as exciting anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that's actually part of what makes the COO role fun as well, is we actually do get to see the fruits of our labor. You know, we're in that operational kind of make it happen role. We get to help the CEO either design or implement the vision, but we also get to see, because we're kind of in that leadership role, our work actually gets used. How have you continued to grow your skill set over the years?
It's a hard question to ask. I think you learn through seeing problems, solving problems, making mistakes, and not ignore your mistakes. So the only real advice I have to people is be really honest with the mistakes you're making. I'm looking back at Talkdesk, and I'm in tech for over 20 years, and I think of my time at Talkdesk as probably one of the top three learning and growth opportunities I had in my career, because our fastest company grew. So you look back and you ask yourself, where do I grow? And even when you're 40 or 50 or 60, you have to continue to ask this question: how can I continue to grow? What will challenge me? And what challenges you is actually just taking a lot of action, doing a lot of things, because when you do things, you get good results, somehow good results and horrible results. And if you don't ignore the outcomes, you can learn from it. The person you hired and was a wrong hire and how you dealt with it. And the person you hired was a phenomenal hire, and you know how you promote this person, gave them latitude. So a lot of my learning and growth is really just paying attention to my mistakes and not ignoring them and not blaming them on somebody else.
So you're pretty introspective as well, then.
I try to, and we all I think tell ourselves a story. It's not common, and memories are funny this way. But I think if you only tell yourself a story, you're never going to grow. If you're always going to be the person say, trust me, I've done before, you're never going to grow, because what you've done before is irrelevant. The world is changing all the time. It sounds like a cliche, but it's true. And if the world is changing all the time and you have done it before and this is your claim to fame, then you're not growing that much, and you're probably building what needed to be built 15 years ago, but not what you need to do today.
Okay, so I'm talking about what we need to do today versus even 15 years ago. The whole business climate, the business world, all the technology tools that are coming now, it's happening faster and faster, it seems. So what are you doing, and what are you doing for the organization to ensure that you guys stay ahead of the curve on everything?
It's a good and complex question. The first thing that I think you need to do is be part of this change. You cannot, you know, my father is almost 90 years old, and when Google launched Google Docs, he was probably 80. He sent me some of my financial information he was managing for me back in Israel on a Google Docs, and see how cool it is, we can collaborate on it. So an 80 years old was one of the earliest adopters of Google Docs, and was enjoying the fact we can collaborate across continents on a financial spreadsheet. And I'm seeing myself and trying to be the same person. When the scooters in San Francisco, I jump on them and give them a try. When you know, the jump bicycle, I try to go around and use them as this new technology. I try to use them as well, because without immersing yourself in everything new, you will never be able to use it. You cannot actually look at the world and say, oh, it's changing. I'm too old for that. It's not for me. It's for kids. You know, Snapchat is for kids, because there's something to learn about Snapchat and from Snapchat, even in the enterprise. There's something to learn from blockchain. All these new technologies are, some are interesting, even if they're only tangential. So part of what I'm trying to do is immerse myself in everything new and hang out with people from all ages. Some of my friends are 20 years younger than me. Some of them are 20 years older than me. And being around people from all ages and all areas is really helpful. So I think the first and most important part of it is just be part of this, of the technological change, and really understand it, rather than saying, you know what, this is for the new company. When you look at older companies and they develop really slow, a lot of it is because they think that their magic sauce or secret sauce is about the technology they build a product on, or about what customers want 10 years ago, and not about this changing market. So keep thinking about it, keep being part of it, keep trying to be part of this world. To me, is the best thing I could do to bring back this this innovation to the company.
So when you're so open to innovation and change and what's happening and what's new, and you're kind of exploring, how are you staying in the day to day? Do you devote a certain portion of your time to kind of focusing on operations and execution and some around kind of the future of where we're going? Or is thinking about the future and change just part of your view of strategy for the company? Kind of walk us through your mindset around that.
It's more of the latter. I don't claim to be your typical operational person that can organize their day into blocks of 1 hour. I wish I could. My brain doesn't work this way. So my day is more of a mashup of many different things. I try to focus on what's most important at any given time. And I think that vision, strategy actually happen naturally when you do everything else. So my role puts me in a position of meeting a lot of customers. So I have a lot of conversation both with prospects and customers, and each one of them teaches you different things. The prospect teaches you about what they want and how they see the future. The customers give you a really good view of what you do well and what you don't, and how can you help them. In my specific role, I actually call customer service a lot. Like, ask my wife. I volunteer to take her own customer service calls because I want to experience how it feels as a customer to call 50 different companies and get service from them. I use a lot of our customers' products, so I can, in the queues, call their customer service and see how it goes, and I have a really good icebreaker with my customers. So all this mashup helps create this view of what the company needs to go. I spend a lot of time with CEO and understand his vision as well. He started a company, he got it to where it is. His vision is critical, and this is what's unique about companies. It's not necessarily the hired help. It's actually the vision that started a company that still needs to live within. And all this kind of create a mashup of what I think the company strategy is. But, you know, maybe another way to answer that is that when you hire really good people and all the areas I'm running have really good leaders, the operation part become less taxing, and you can focus on helping them make some of the harder decisions and some of the areas that they're not sure about, but you don't have to manage it day to day. And this is the biggest gift you can get from your leadership team is the gift of not needing to manage their day to day.
So how do you, so walk me through, first off, how do you stay in sync with the CEO on his vision? And are there systems used for that? Is there meeting rhythms you have? How do you, you know, get on the same page and stay on the same page? And then secondly, how do you try to free up time? And do you work on helping your direct reports free up their time?
I think there's not much you can learn from the way I interact with Thiago here, because he is different probably from anybody else that I know. He's young. He's 31 years old. A lot of the communication is various forms of chat. We probably chat 50 times a day in all sort of weird hours of day and night. And we meet a lot informally. Actually, we don't have a lot of organized one-on-ones, but we'll grab a lunch here or just take a walk here or go for a drink or sometimes just socialize together. And we never really socialize and don't think about work. Even when we go have a drink or go out sometime when we travel, it's really a mix of talking about work and personal stuff and get this trust built that is essential for this type of work. And I would say, as a general advice here, is you have to communicate with your CEO the way he wants or she wants to communicate with. You cannot really say, oh, you know, I have to have the one-on-one Monday on Friday. I heard this is what Sheryl and Mark Zuckerberg are doing. Everyone has different cadence based on how they think about things, and our cadence is much more continuous than formal meetings at the beginning of every week. To me, part of my trick too is there are certain topics I'll bring in chat, there's certain topics I bring over the phone, there's certain topics I bring in person. So knowing the person you work with really well helps me decide which topics I want to discuss right now because they're urgent and which topics can wait 2-3 weeks for the right time for an in-person conversation. Being patient is actually a really good skill for a CEO.
A very good skill. Now, are you guys operating out of the same office space or are you in different offices? Or different
we're
cities?
In the same office space. With travel schedule, we sometimes don't see each other for a month and a half, where we don't overlap for a long period of time, but we work of the same office and we try to spend a good amount of time together.
Now, one of my mantras over the years has been that the leader's job is to grow people. And I've just always believed that the more that we grow our direct reports and the more we help them grow their direct reports, in terms of growing their operational skills, their leadership skills, any of the soft skills of management, the faster the company will accelerate. Can you kind of give me any of your insights on growing people? And then secondly, you know, what mantras do you operate by or do you kind of keep front of mind? Or
To me, the most important thing for any leader that worth their pay is they want to have a sense of agency. They want to be the one driving their unit and making decisions. And if you go back to how I learn, which is doing and making mistakes, you cannot learn if you only execute someone else's ideas, because then it's never your mistakes. your mistakes are actually in the way you carried the operation, but not necessarily in the decision that led to it. So if this is the way I learned, this is the way I want my direct reports to learn. And I honestly try to be as little as possible in their way and give them as much freedom as possible. And I often tell them, don't listen to me. Or here's my opinion, but call BS any time because I'm not sure I'm right. And I encourage that because I don't want people to think that if I said something, it is more important than what they said. In some cases, we formalize it. For example, when we in a hiring process and what we call tribals, we actually going to talk by seniority. So the more senior people will talk last. So we don't create, if I don't like someone, we don't bias everybody else. But in some other cases, you will have an opinion, nobody else will talk, and you want to make sure that you're a challenge. And part of my trick here is say, I think I may be wrong, so please don't take it as gospel, but here's what I think. Do you think differently? Or call my BS if you think it's I'm BSing. And sometimes people do that. But again, going back, if you don't give people freedom, then you're not going to get much out of them, and you actually don't need to hire very senior people. If you want to run a company with 100, 200 people, and they're just going to carry your decisions, you actually can hire pretty junior people. They may love it. But if you hire senior people who want to grow, part of growing is doing, deciding, and making your own mistakes and learn from them.
Yeah, that's a huge lesson, by the way. So many people try to hire senior people and they don't treat them like senior people at all. And I think you touched on something that I covered in my book, Meetings Suck. I was trying to really codify how companies can run really great meetings. And one of the systems I put in there was that leaders should speak last. And that you even touched on that you don't want to sway the group. You don't want your comments to steer them in a direction. So I think it's a really powerful lesson for sure.
And you also need to know yourself. And I think when you have a stronger personality, and many people in this area have strong personality and strong opinions, you're not going to change. You're not going to become someone else that doesn't have an opinion or always speak with question marks. And I try to do that, but it's more of a tactic than a strategy. I have strong opinions about things, and Tiago, my CEO, has strong opinions about things. And if you want to allow others to have opinions as well, you can't really hide your opinions, but you can just handicap them by saying, I may be wrong. It may not be true. I didn't do the homework. I don't have the research to support it. And you leave a lot of openings for people to contradict you, but also look for people that will. If you're a strong personality, you need to look for other people with strong personalities so they feel comfortable challenging you. If you are a strong personality and you hire a bunch of yes people, nobody's ever going to challenge you. Even if you make all the comments in the world and say, hey, challenge me. If you don't have strong people around you, they're not going to challenge you.
Yeah, we started an organization called the COO Alliance, which is the only network of its kind in the world for second in commands. And one of our members was kind of rolling his eyes recently thinking about his CEO, and he said that he really doesn't even give me a chance to chime in. It's just kind of his way or the highway. And I'm really starting to see a fracture there that this guy really needs to get something changing, or he's going to lose a really strong hire as well. With your growth in terms of the hiring of people, you mentioned that you want people that are going to challenge you and be strong leaders. So how do you identify strong leaders in the interview process, or how do you even go ahead of the interview process in the job postings and the recruiting? How do you recruit strong leaders?
I wish I had all the right answers for that. Then I will never make hiring mistakes ever again. I discovered something interesting about myself. There are rare cases when I actually really know the right person. The person sitting in front of me is the right person. It's rare. It happens twice a year, maybe. And in this case, I was never wrong. When I feel super strong about someone, I'm yet to be wrong. But it's happened, pretty rarely. And I'm also still hiring people that become really strong. And I didn't feel this way from the beginning. So the first thing I learned is that when I feel really, really strong about someone, I usually don't make a mistake, and this person should be hired. I don't know why, what is this feeling, how has it happened, but I think it's a combination of seeing someone really driven, that know what they want, understand how to get it done, and can describe how they've done before. But it's also something which I cannot explain. I can go back and say, here are all the people that I really felt 10 minutes in that they are the right people, but there's not much in common between them. the different genders, the different races, there are different steps in the stages in their career for different roles, and there's something about them, and maybe it's experience that made me feel very strongly about them. When it comes to the vast majority, I think there's several things you have to do, and the first one is don't only trust yourself. Open the interview process to as many people as possible in the organization. Make sure they know what you're looking for. Make sure they know you. It's not really useful to bring someone that just joined 2 weeks ago and ask them to participate in an interview process if they don't know what the company wants and what you want. And do a lot of back channel reference check. Don't rely on HR to do reference checks for you. Don't rely on the references the candidate gives you, but do a lot of reference checks and do them yourself and ask the question that you're worried about. You know, not too long ago, I interviewed a senior leader that I ended up not hiring, and there are several question marks that I had during the interview, and I spent probably 5 hours reaching out to different people, having long half an hour conversation until I was able to validate in this case that I was right in my instinct, and the person was not truthful in the interview process. But I had to spend this time, otherwise I would have had the wrong candidate.
You may have just touched on it. I know you've got a few, but I think you may have just touched on one of the core reasons why you're successful, and it's your interviewing, hiring, and reference check process. Even though you said, you know, you wish you were right more often or had it all figured out, the fact that you actually spend that much time, you're one of only a few senior leaders I've ever spoken to, and I'm very much like you. I did 12 reference checks on a guy, Christopher Bennett, years ago, seven personal, 5 business to people he didn't give me the names for. I dug up and then made him get me their contact info. And it was because my spider senses were saying that there's no way this kid at 23 years old could really be as good as he said. He was almost like a Renaissance man. And I was like, but it seems like my spider senses are saying he is, but if he really is that good, people must hate him. And I just needed to know. Turns out everybody I spoke to said the kid was amazing. And one of them was his current boss at the time. He said, wow, you've got my best guy. And Christopher Bennett ended up literally being kind of one of the core reasons why 1-800-GOT-JUNK became what it was. He was a huge cultural hire for us. But it was the reference checks that made it okay to go in and make that hire. And trusting your gut, I'm the same. Like, I've had only probably 3 people that I can remember in my career, David Crombie, Mark Rubin, and then maybe Christopher Bennett, that I just kind of knew at my gut level out of hundreds that I've hired, at my gut level, like, yeah, they're going to be amazing. Like, you just know, right? So do you trust your gut in other decisions in the business, or do you kind of operate more under Google? Like, I don't care what you think. I need to know what the data is.
It's a little bit of both. I trust my gut a lot. And I think as a senior leader, when you're a little far away from the day-to-day data, what I often ask people is, don't try to out-gut me. My gut will win. The CEO's gut will win because we are more senior, we're more experienced, and Diego started the company. His gut will win every time. You come with data and you come with research, and then you can, you know, persuade my gut that I'm wrong. So I like to look at data. I think data is super important. I always ask, in say product meetings, start with the data, start with the research, start with how you form your opinion. Because if you just have an opinion, my opinion will win. So part of it is knowing how you need to challenge your gut, because it's going to be right in many cases, but your gut is actually a reflection of your past. It's not a reflection of the future. What we call gut is our total experiences. It's a very normal thing. And if we remember that our gut actually is a reflection of the past and not of the future, we need to allow ourselves to keep challenging it, because otherwise we're going to continue doing the same things over and over again. And so I'm asking to keep challenging me, keep bringing data, keep showing me something else, and I will be convinced. But don't tell me my gut feel is this, because it's a very hard argument to win with somebody more senior than you.
That's a really interesting perspective, that our gut is a reflection. Because I've always looked at the gut as kind of our human computer, right? And the gut is a reflection of our past, that if we're building a company into the future, everything, the rules all change. The use of technology change, the way businesses are running, the speed of change. The people that were good working with us 10 years ago probably aren't going to be as good, or they need to be very different going forward.
Yeah, and part of the appeal for me of joining a company where the CEO back at that time, founder and CEO, was under 30, and did pretty well growing the company until I joined, was there's something that he does and he knows that I don't. Maybe it's the years between us. Maybe it's the fact he came from Portugal and come from a different culture. And maybe it's the composition of his character. But there's something he knows and he does and I don't. If I always going to tell him, you're wrong, I'm right, because I'm experienced, then I'm going to build the past. So part of building the future is collaborating with people that think differently than you. And you know, they may be wrong, because it doesn't mean your gut is right probably 80% of the time. And what worked in the past, probably going to work in the future 80% of the time. But you always need to seek for this 20%, because the 80% is, you know, what's right is right. If you there's some basic things that will always be true. If you run out of money, your company is going to cease from operating. This is true. No need to argue it. It was true in the past. It will be true in the future. But there are things that are not as black and white. And for this, you need to really work with people who challenge you. And doesn't matter if they're the founders or new employees that just joined. Somebody will always be able to tell you something. The onus of proving it is higher when you're more junior or less experienced.
That's interesting. And I love that you're actually making people think and debate it as well, because that's growing their skill sets too. This is a random question that just kind of came to me, and it's really related to the organization as a whole, kind of the org chart and structure. I was just kind of thinking about Zappos and this organizational structure that Tony Hsieh tried to implement a few years ago with kind of the flat organization, no titles. Do you guys, what's your org chart look like? How do you operate with, you know, an organizational structure and titles, et cetera?
We operate in a environment where a lot of people care about titles, and I think that Zappos had a unique opportunity to hire in a place that didn't really have a deep rooted culture of titles and VPs and EVPs and RVPs and so on. When you bring in people from Salesforce and LinkedIn and you know, companies in the Valley, they expect to have titles. So we're not very different. We have VPs here. We have directors. We try not to have too many layers. So for us, a VP is someone that can own an area. An SVP is someone can own multiple areas. We have only one C-level person or two C-level person people, CEO and myself. And we try to keep it as such. We're trying not to create inflation of titles. But honestly, I do understand that at some point of time, this is what Salesforce did in 05, 06, you have to create more layers because people want to see growth. And especially now, people want to see every year or two, they want to see a promotion and a career growth. And if you don't have enough layers you can demonstrate, it's only about money, it's about public recognition, you're going to end up losing some good people that want to see this career progression. So we're not that religious about that. I think there's being flat in titles, but also being flat in communication. And a way to work directly with people. And I will tell you, this company, if the CEO wants to run an idea by a product manager, he does it. And we don't care that there's two, three layers between the CEO and the product manager, and nobody takes it personally. So why was it not to see it on this email? Like, you have a question, ask it. You want to run an idea, do it. It doesn't make the company less effective.
Good for you. Yeah, you're kind of avoiding all the bureaucracy and the pain in the ass of it, but still giving structure that people need day to day too. Like, people, humans still want to know where they fit and where they line up. And I completely agree on the need for titles and for roles as people are moving up in the organization too. So how are you guys competing in the Bay Area? I mean, you're in a very, very competitive environment. In the last few years, there's been a lot of talk about companies even leaving the Bay Area because it's so hard to keep talent, let alone get it. How are you guys, competing and winning in the war on talent? What are you doing that's working well for you?
I have to acknowledge that this is an area that we don't have a really good answer. So Toctus has three main locations. We have most of our R&D is actually in Portugal, in Lisbon and in Porto. This is where the company started, where the first engineers came from. So one of the advantages we have is that in Lisbon and in Porto, we are one of the top 3-4 startups that people want to join. So the war on talent there, because the tech industry is newer, is simpler for us. And we build a really strong brand of a company with advanced technology, with great challenges for engineers. And almost every engineer in Lisbon and Porto will interview and talk to us. So one big area for us, which is R&D and some of the other areas, is actually covered by the fact that we ended up starting the company in a smaller location and became one of the top three startups in the country, which gives us this amazing access to talent and the ability to hire and retain really good engineers that, from an education perspective, from experience perspective, are very similar to the one we would be able to hire here, if not better, because we have the first pick on most every engineer. We have a second location in Salt Lake City, and the reason we have a location there is that one of our biggest competitor, InContact, is there, and a lot of the company was acquired a couple of years ago. A lot of people are leaving the company now, and it was just an opportunity for us to hire good talent in an area where that really cares about the problems that we're solving, which is another very important piece. Do you really join a company because you care about the mission, or just a cool tech company that grows fast and you want it on your resume? And a lot of the people we hire in Salt Lake actually really care about the mission. They want to build a better customer service platform, and they care about our mission, and therefore they join. And San Francisco, which I kept kind of last, is much more challenging. There is a combination of people that want to join because they care about our mission and they care about what we do. But a lot of people join because they want a great name on their resume. And it's hard. It's an objective problem that is hard to resolve. And in recent conversations with other CEOs and CEOs and investors, I think we need to acknowledge that in San Francisco, an average tenure of employee might be anything between a year and a half to two. Great one that got multiple career promotions will maybe stay for 3 years, but we're looking at different job markets where you have people coming and going in the course of a couple of years, and needs to impact training, onboarding, and other hiring strategies because the market is changing. Listen, I don't blame anyone here for a 20-some years old employee that maybe graduated a couple of years ago. It's a Disneyland of opportunities. And all of them look very, very similar. And again, think of somebody at Disneyland, like, how do I decide which ride do I go first? I think a lot of it is because of that. It's a great time. The economy is booming. The San Francisco economy is booming. People have a lot of opportunities, and it's hard for them to choose.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I think that's, it's smart to actually even understand that as an organization too, that we have to attract people. We've got to try to retain people. And then I also have reasonable ideas on how long they're really going to stay, because I'm surprised you even said a year and a half to two. I probably would have gone like 9 months to 18 months in the Bay Area, but it's nice to hear that they are staying a little bit longer. So I want to wrap up with just one question. And it's not a framed question that I ask everybody, but I'm just curious for you. What's the core, if you were to give advice to someone going into a second in command role for the first time, regardless on the size of the organization, what would kind of the one, big lesson be that you would pass on?
I would say really focus on number one, and on the number one in this case, and make sure that there's something about this person you deeply respect. Because if you come to an organization, you think you're better than the founder, CEO in any way you can imagine, just this is a big red flag. Don't join. You have to have this person have to have at least one towering strength that you respect, and you want to learn from and you want to work with. It's clear that many of the second in commands are going to be better in many other things than the founder CEO. But if you don't have one thing you really respect about this person, it's not going to work. You're going to continue fighting because you think you're going to better in everything than this person. So I would look at this. If there's one thing, I would look at this one thing and ask myself, do I respect this person? Is there something special about this person that I want to learn from? If not, just walk. It's never going to work.
Interesting. I love that. And it's interesting. I was doing an interview with Forbes magazine with the print edition about a month and a half ago on an article on female COOs. And they were saying that, the interviewer said, well, most COOs, most second in commands, obviously want to be CEOs someday. And I went, yeah, not really. Like from the group that I've seen, it feels like an awful lot of the second in commands are really, really happy being in that role, and they don't ever want to be the entrepreneur or the CEO. Is that similar for you, or do you have aspirations to move into a CEO role someday once you've kind of continued to build out Talkdesk?
So I've been in leadership positions where I was the leader, and I've been number two. I've experienced this even in the Army as a company commander, but before that as a deputy to a company commander, and I enjoy both. I think there's something special about being number one that you cannot get by being number two. And the most important part of the most important part of being number one to me is being able to fully control or fully influence the culture and the spirit of the company. And this is something you cannot really do as number two, and I often miss it. So I will probably be a CEO, or probably maybe be again a CEO. I tend to flex. Part of, I mean, my personality is I tend to flex and look for what's the right opportunity for me at any specific moment. But I do like being number one, and I do like being number two with the right number one.
Well, it sounds like you've got a great number one that you're working with, and also a great path ahead of you with Talkdesk as well. So Gadi Shamia, thank you sincerely for the time that you spent today and for some of the insights you gave us. I was scribbling notes the whole time, and I can't wait to re-listen to this as well.
I think it was great talking with you. And I was just seeing a 1-800 junk truck just driving under me as we were speaking.
That's funny. I actually left 1-800-GOT-JUNK 11 years ago next week. I left as the COO there. That was a long time past, but that was a great, great part of our career for sure. Gadi, thanks very much for the time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, take care.
You've been listening to Second in Command, brought to you by COO Alliance founder Cameron Harold. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe. For more best practices from industry-leading COOs, visit COOalliance.com.